The Guardian.
Hello everyone, welcome to Guardian Football Weekly Extra International Break Special. Today, the final World Cup places are up for grabs. We'll look ahead to all of them, get expert opinions on Sweden and Australia, and we'll get Barry's on Ireland, plus VAR in the England game tomorrow. How's it gone down in Europe so far? And who will be in Everton's promotional video for their new manager? And will it be more exciting than David Moyes' one at West Ham? All that, plus a big old Q&A in Part 3, Feedback Corner, and that's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Representing Ireland today, Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Representing France, Philippe Auclair.
Bonjour.
And representing Wales, Ellis James.
Hello.
Debut, Ellis.
Yeah. I'm here to mix things up.
Absolutely.
I'm the gorilla in the room.
You know, when I first met you, you did say that you were a big fan of Barry Glendenning.
Yes.
So I don't often meet...
A lot has been made about this on Twitter.
Right.
But for the benefit of the listeners...
Yeah.
Barry looks exactly how I imagine all football journalists to look. And it's because he just seemed to be the final piece of the jigsaw. And when I saw him, I thought, of course, that is how football journalists look.
So what is so football journalist-y about Barry?
Slightly unshaven. Although not today, in fairness to you.
Mm. I thought I'd make an effort for you. Because I heard, and I quote, that you've a crush on
Just a slight hangdog expression. Yeah. Slightly jaded.
Slightly?
Well... But he can still bang out a few hundred words, you know, to a tight deadline. No one files copy like Glendenning.
No, no one can even dream of filing copy gosh. Like Glendenning. Oh, well, that's great. And you're happy to being that close. I was wondering if you really liked Barry to have you further away so you could focus on your own game.
No, I'll make my move when I see fit. I'm very good at spotting a gap.
We should point out, for the benefit of say, listeners further afield in the UK, that you know we're in the midst of celebrity greatness here, not yours.
Oh, I thought you were about to be very kind to me there.
You know, Ellis is a successful comedian, mm-hmm. a sitcom star, mm-hmm. hosts a radio show, mm-hmm. appears on our radio show as our Swansea correspondent. Mm-hmm. And you have your own football podcast, don't you?
Yes, with Iwan Roberts and Danny Gabbardon. I'm in a WhatsApp group with Iwan Roberts and Danny Gabbardon.
That's great.
It is the best thing I've ever achieved.
Do you do it just professionally, or do you just? Or are you on it all the time? Are you on it more than them?
No, actually. It's professional up until the recording of the podcast, and then it's just banter. It's great.
Are you worried? I was worried that Ellis might be too funny for the pod.
No,
you should be worried. I'm not.
Okay.
I'm okay.
Okay, that's fine.
It's, you know, I'll be fairly wry and glib, and then when it comes to some things, my lack of knowledge will be severely exposed. Mm. But you know, I'm not here to be an expert. Or am I?
Hopefully, it's okay not to have expert knowledge on every part.
Yeah, we're tired of experts, aren't we?
Yeah, we're over experts, thankfully. David Moyes appointed, saying he's going to go back to how he was at Preston and hopes the players won't cry, Philippe.
At Preston?
When he started there, he used to work players really hard, and he had a real hunger and a drive and a desire, and he didn't care what people thought. He had no time for egos, presumably because there weren't any egos there.
Apart from David Beckham.
Ah, yeah.
You had him for a few months, didn't he? So he actually even played together, because he was player-manager, wasn't he, David Moyes at Preston?
Yeah.
Why not Everton?
Well,
he didn't have exactly the reputation of being easy with those snowflakes at Everton.
No, that's true. He did what he did say at Preston, and when he started at Everton. Then he said, you know, when you get a bit older, you get a bit more mature, and you maybe ease off a little bit.
So we won't see the cosmopolitan David Moyes we saw in San Sebastian tasting the delight of food of the north western Spain.
Yeah, but he did get some criticism, Barry, from Sunderland fans when he arrived and said, this is a disaster and it will be a disaster. And he hasn't... He's learnt from that, at least.
Well, he's got more criticism from Sunderland fans since being appointed at West Ham, because he said he didn't do due diligence at the club and he shouldn't have taken the job. And Sunderland fans have taken umbrage at this, you know, and I think most Sunderland fans concede the club is a basket case, but you know, it's our basket case. And when he took over, you know, he took over in July, so he had a full season with them. He had a big transfer kitty, which he seems to have conveniently overlooked. He wasted most of it on substandard players, most of whom, or many of whom, are still there, stinking the place up, and they can't be got rid of because their wages are too high. And but when he arrived at Sunderland, they'd only lost 2 of their previous 15 matches. In one of their most recent matches, they'd be just beaten Chelsea. They'd beaten Everton 3-0. You know, they weren't a disaster on the field. It could be argued he took over the best Sunderland squad that's been there for several years. Now, admittedly,
that's a low bar.
The bar is low. Yes, you beat me to it. But, you know, they weren't that bad when he took over, and he seems to have absolved himself of all blame for taking them down, when it's not entirely his fault, but a large part of it is his fault. So, you know, I just need to get that out of the way first. And I've noticed a lot of journalists in the press giving him quite an easy ride, and saying, you know, well, he was good at Everton. And, yeah, he was good at Everton. But that was a long time ago, and he has a lot to prove. And but he's given himself a clean slate now. We'll see how he gets on. I do know Kevin Kilbane thinks very highly of him, and said, you know, his training sessions were interesting. He treats players well, and he's a good guy. So Kevin would know him a lot better than I would. Kevin was with him at Preston and then at Everton. So.
Would he inspire you, Ellis?
Well, I just think, certainly not as a West Ham United fan, and I just think he got £5 million compensation from United. Why do it to yourself, David? Have a nice life. Yeah. It's just, he was 10 months at United, 9 months at Sociedad, 10 months at Sunderland. He hasn't succeeded anywhere for a very long time. And they're already upset that, you know, they're at the London Stadium. It's just such an uninspiring move, I think.
You know, since Everton, he has basically gone from impossible job to impossible job.
He does count the Charity Shield as a trophy, though.
Okay.
So
in fairness to him, he said it was not his trophy. It was a trophy won by Alex Ferguson's team. Yeah. I remember him saying that at the time.
But it's almost like he's got a recruitment consultant who's, you know, rings him up and says, I've got a great job for you. Because the recruitment just wants to place him somewhere just to get some more commission. Because West Ham is not easy, is it? Especially when it says the stadium is just a total disaster.
Yeah, I mean, it's now become a cliche, but you look at the squad, and it would have been a great squad about 5 years ago. And it's so uninspiring. I actually dread when I'm asked to go to the London Stadium, apologies West Ham fans, just because it doesn't feel like a football stadium, it doesn't feel like a football game. Perhaps the only time when I really felt it looked a bit like a football stadium was in the defeat against Tottenham. When they had, they tried to get back into the game and nearly did so at the end of the match. But it seems to be, I've lost count of the number of attacking players they've signed over the last 3 or 4 years. We're way into double figures, and it hasn't worked at all. Yeah, it's a bit strange. Talking about recruitment, I was intrigued by the signings he made at Sunderland. I've just had a look. Wow,
is it a who's who?
Well, I can give you
Steven Pienaar, Didier Ndong, Victor Anichebe, Paddy McNair, Donald Love, Papi Djilobodji, the immortal, Mika, Joleon Lescott in January 2017.
Now, played twice.
Yeah. Darren Gibson, Brian Oviedo. That's the extent of... players it took.
Quite a few of those are still there.
That's extraordinary. Yeah.
Do they have a huge squad, Sunderland? Are they one of those teams?
No, but they do have quite a lot of players earning huge amounts of money on long contracts that they can't get rid of.
Hey, what about Stuart Pearce joining David Moyes, Philippe?
That baffles me. It baffles me, genuinely. I suppose, is he supposed to be the guy who does those rousing speeches before the games?
David Moyes has found the one person with a more piercing stare than himself.
Can you imagine those two? It's the basilisk.
Yeah.
Although, which one of them is good cop?
Well, sometimes, you know, you could get Pierce on sort of talking about The Who and punk music.
Sex
and
Pistols
stuff.
He loves.
Yeah, he loves that. Mm. And he also comes out with brilliant, not quite correct sayings like,
but talk about hangdog. Yeah. I mean, you could give lessons. You could be a lecturer in hangdoggery.
But he did once say, we can see the carrot at the end of the tunnel, which I really liked. Didn't he bring on, was he the City manager?
Yes.
Who brought on David James up front? It was 2 minutes to go and they needed a goal and he put David James up front.
It must have been.
What, for his height?
He left, John Macken was on the bench. Imagine you're John Macken. And there's a great footage, you should find it, where David James is basically sort of lolloping about the penalty area, commits one terrible foul and doesn't really do a whole lot. It was the final day of the 2005 season.
He hated being praised, Stuart Pearce, because he thought, if I'm praised, that means I can't improve. So he actually wanted to be barracked and shouted at.
Okay.
Which is one of the many differences between myself and Stuart Pearce. I really need an arm around the shoulder, I've got to be honest.
What is also surprising is that Stuart Pearce is very much an old school style of manager, whereas Moyes might give the impression that he is. But when you talk to people who've worked with him, and especially at Everton, he's somebody who is incredibly systematic and detailed and actually quite, you know, on finger on the button when it comes to modern coaching and so forth. So it seems a bit of a strange recruitment. He's just think people need not just one but two kicks up the arse.
He's just not a winner. He won League One with Preston and then he got them promoted. And then he won the Charity Shield the Community Shield with Man United. And that is it. To go from big job to big job without having won a few trophies, I find extraordinary. He was at Everton, who were traditionally one of the biggest teams in English football,
mm-hmm.
and was regarded as a success. And yet, you know, they haven't won a trophy since 1995.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Maybe I'm too into glory.
What do we might make of Emanalo leaving Chelsea? Philippe, what does this mean?
That is a scratch head moment. I think it's very difficult to tell exactly what it genuinely means. I think it is a personal decision. He wasn't sacked, first thing. Also, it seems now established that he was not a victim of the power struggle between Antonio Conte and Marina Granovskaya and so forth. And it was very much a personal decision. He seems to have a decent, very decent job and probably a quieter job lined up in Monaco, where I think he would be probably a good fit. And it's the consequences which are very difficult to measure as well, because many people saw him as the kind of the diplomat in a club where you needed to have diplomats. He'd been in place for 10 years.
He was the meniscus in the knee. He was the shock absorber, wasn't he? He sort of took all the...
Yeah.
Everyone always blamed him for everything, really.
And his record, in fairness, was pretty damn good, considering how low the opinion people had of him when he arrived at the club. I remember some people within the club talking about him in very, very unflattering terms, actually quite... almost contempt. Who is that guy? He knows nothing. Because he was not very, he arrived from nowhere and he was the opposition scout and he was not perhaps the most systematic of opposition scouts. His reports were a little bit shoddy, but very quickly he grew into the job and he brought some really tremendous players to Chelsea. I mean, people forget that, De Bruyne, for example, and Lukaku came because of him. It's not his fault that they actually dropped, they left the club afterwards.
Barry, were you laughing at my meniscus analogy?
Yeah.
The shock absorber.
Well, when you said meniscus, before you finished the sentence, I thought, oh, God, he's talking about Greek myths.
I've
never heard of him. Is he the one that flew to the sun?
Barry, what about Big Sam being favourite for the Everton job?
I heard him on TalkSport this morning, and he wasn't talking about Everton, but he was breathing really heavily into the microphone while someone was doing a newspaper review.
Yes,
a very sinister way.
Well, I've done that show with Big Sam,
yeah,
and he does breathe quite loudly. And I'm not at the stage to be like, just sit back there, Sam. Although I was doing, it's not as bad as I did one show with Ray Wilkins, where he came back from injury too early and he had some kind of heart monitor thing, and for the first 10 minutes of the show it was kind of, you just heard this bzzz, and you thought someone's phone was on, and we're like, what is that? You're doing the show, but you're sort of looking around going, what is this? And it was something sort of connected to Ray. He's like, I'll just switch it off. We're like, no, keep it on, Ray. Yes, but Sam, actually, I heard Sam when they were going through the odds for next manager, and basically he's always in the odds for all of them, and he was much more coy about the USA job. When they were like, he's sort of 1-4 on favourite for that.
Was he coy or coquettish? I'm not sure I can imagine Sam Allardyce being coy.
To be coquettish, don't you have to be sort of
wearing
lingerie and kneeling on a bed while twirling your hair with a finger? I don't want to imagine Big Sam being
coquettish. To be honest, he looked good on Match of the Day in that open shirt and chain. I think that's he's only one step away from lingerie. Yeah.
Now, he did say on TalkSport this morning, today being Thursday, that he hadn't spoken to the Everton chairman, Mashiri, because he'd been at a League Managers Association conference in St. Andrews. But he certainly didn't rule himself out of the job. I would imagine it's probably his if he wants it. I mean, your pal Merce reckons Diego Simeone would jump at the chance of taking the...
Does he?
Yeah.
What?
Oh. Yeah. Merce has had a moment, a Merce moment.
Oh, well, I love Merce.
I love Merce.
We all love Merce.
But do we... I don't...
Yeah.
Can we see Simeone? I mean, he'd have to...
I wanted someone to clear this up for me because I read an article where it said the Everton board's wish list included Sam Allardyce and Simeone. And I thought to myself, if you gave me Simeone and Allardyce as the answer, I wouldn't be able to work out what the question was. And maybe I'm out of touch, but... Surely he's not going to... I mean, that's pretty fanciful, isn't it?
It would only be... I mean, I don't know if anybody knows...
Not as fanciful as Carlo Ancelotti being booted.
Mm. But I mean, unless Simeone absolutely loves money to such a ridiculous degree and Mashiri wants to give him even, like, 100 times more, you wouldn't go, would you?
He's not from Fazakerley, so he's, you know... It's not like he grew up supporting Everton. I just found it extraordinary that he was in the mix. But, you know, Everton are in a relegation battle. They need someone to keep them up, first off, I think.
Sounds like Big Sam. But, you see, it seems to me like Big Sam wants a job where he can just go in, sort it out, get a lot of money, leave in the summer, have, like, 6 months off, you know, get another tan, and then come back in February. And that's not what the Everton job is it?
Not really. But, you know, maybe what they need is a ferryman at the moment, somebody just to take that to the end of that particular season, and that would be that would be it. He would do that, Sam. I mean, there's one thing you can't argue with. I mean, his record in this particular kind of situation is actually pretty damn good. Yeah. So, but there's a long-term appointment. Anyway, there'll be need of such a shake-up in terms of squad. Again, in the summer, obviously.
I mean, January.
January again. Can they go and spend a lot of money in January?
Is Thomas Tuchel not the obvious choice for Everton?
Well, Everton is a club where you need to understand to get the club. It's different from the others. I know everybody will say that you need to fit in.
Can someone explain this to me?
It's because, okay.
The fabric of the club.
The fabric.
The DNA.
The DNA of the club. It's extraordinarily important at Everton, perhaps more than any other English club I can think of.
Why?
And because of the way it is structured. Because, for example, one of the reasons why Koeman, it ended so badly and so quickly was that there was suddenly, between the end of last season and the beginning of this season, there was a complete disconnect between Ronald Koeman and the rest of, I would consider, the club. The first team became a kind of a bubble. And what is essential for Everton, for example, is the communication between the youth side and the first team. It's always been a principle on them. It's also a club where people... It's a very traditional club in so many ways. I mean, people have been placed there for a very long time. And if you don't buy into that...
But surely that must be the same for many football clubs.
You could say it's the same.
But not
the same depth at the same level. And it's also valid for the fans. And the fans are a part of the equation. And if the fans think they've got a manager who doesn't, inverted commas, get the club at Everton, the consequences tend to be quickly.
But if Koeman had won the first 10 games of the season, they wouldn't care that he wasn't
talking to
them.
Absolutely. And in fact, if you talk to the fans at the beginning of the season, everybody was on a high because they had signed some really terrific players. And they had the preseason had gone on very, very well. The first games in the Europa League were actually excellent. Mm-hmm. And they started with a win and a draw against Manchester City. And then the wheels came off. But the wheels came off as a result of what had been happening over the past few months in terms of the way the team is structured and the fact that Koeman was withdrawing more and more from the rest of the club.
So then you think the Unsworth-Ebrell dream team should keep it?
Why not?
Because they're not doing very well.
Well, they did all right, Unsworth. I mean, last game, I thought that is a turning point, surely.
Is that? Well, maybe.
You 2-0 down in front of your own crowd, you win 3-2. okay, cleverly misses his penalty and so forth, but they had really, you know, poor luck before that. So it was a huge result, and the crowd was, it was absolutely rocking. It was wonderful. So why not?
Okay.
I don't know.
One man who isn't mentioned for any of these jobs, a guy called Graham Potter. You may not have heard of him. English manager doing amazing things in Sweden. We will begin part two discussing him and Sweden's game with Italy and the rest of the playoffs. That's in just a second. Welcome back to part two of Guardian Football Weekly Extra. We just mentioned Graham Potter, an English manager doing amazing things in Sweden. So we will turn to Marcus Christensen, our football editor, more importantly, a Swede, who can tell us all about Graham and give us a bit on Sweden and Italy and the playoffs. How are you, Marcus?
Very well, thank
Welcome
you.
Welcome to the pod.
Thank you.
Tell us about this lad, Graham Potter, then. It's extraordinary, really,
yeah.
What he's done.
It is quite amazing. So he took over Östersund, which is this tiny club, and they were struggling at the time. They were in the fourth division in Sweden, which is nearly the level I played at, actually. I played one season in the fifth division for Rosersberg.
Oh, exactly. What position did you play, Marcus?
Left midfield. White John Barnes was my nickname, given to me by myself. No one else picked it up, but there we are.
Okay. Did you beat the fullback, or did you just get the ball in? You didn't have to beat the man.
No, I wasn't the quickest, so I curled a cross in for one of my attackers to miss. Beautiful. Spectacularly. Okay. Yeah. So they were in the fourth division when Graham Potter took over, and they won three straight promotions, and then they won the cup and qualified for the Europa League. And he kind of kept picking up players from the Swedish first division or Middlesbrough rejects, or there's even a guy who was let go by York City. And he kind of created this extraordinary team spirit by doing different things. They produced, they did a production of Swan Lake on stage in front of an audience to get the players kind of out of their comfort zone and kind of having to do different stuff. And it's all very, very fascinating. And they've done well, and they need one more win to qualify for the Europa League knockout stage.
Do we know if the Swan Lake was a good performance?
The reviews were quite positive, I believe, yes. I haven't seen it myself, but...
So we were talking about the Iceland manager, and he before a game, will just go into a pub and do like a tactical explanation of what he's picked, and everyone turns their phones off, and you sort of think, well, that's brilliant, and this Swan Lake thing is wonderful, and you think, could you bring any of that sort of stuff to England? But I just can't help thinking, if they put on the Nutcracker, you know... If Southgate got them in and did that.
Guys and Dolls.
You think I Starlight Express.
Yeah.
Although Wilshire would take a tumble, wouldn't he? That'd be an issue. But it just wouldn't work, would it? How does that work in Scandinavia, that's not just completely mocked?
Well, I think, and I was thinking about this regarding the West Ham position and Moyes and so on, and I thought, would it work if you came in and told Andy Carroll to do this, or Chicharito, who scored whatever goals for Mexico and tough like goals, and probably, maybe not. You'd think it would, but another project he did, which I think I mentioned it before, was they lined up all the players in one empty room in the middle of the room and asked questions like, have you ever gone a day without eating or something like that? And if it was yes, they took a step forward, and if it was no, they took a step backwards. And in the end, they've asked all these questions. So two or three players ended up at the front of the wall, staring into the wall, which I think was the privileged ones or something, and the less privileged ended up back, and you kind of looked around, you saw where your teammates were, and he's created this amazing team spirit from it. But you can probably do that with people who've not succeeded, who's ready to give everything for a new chance and so on, whereas I think to come in and do that for Premier League players might be a completely different thing.
Yeah, because Nick Ames wrote a very good article about him in The Guardian yesterday, and he has a couple of wrong-uns and ne'er-do-wells who he's sort of brought over and made to see their ways and given them a new lease of life. Yeah, quite a lot of sort of just, kind of a dirty dozen type thing, isn't it?
That was Brian Clough's thing. He was convinced that he could cure you. So if you were a talented player, he would ask you, what is your vice? Is it alcohol or is it gambling? You know, with your personal life, is it women that gets you in trouble? And then, as long as they were honest, he was convinced that he could, you know, transform a ragtag team of talented individuals who'd been written off.
Yeah.
Barry, what's your vice?
Probably booze.
That's all I wanted to know. I have no further questions. Graham Potter, is he mentioned at all for any jobs over? I mean, he's not mentioned for jobs over here. Does he like it that way? Do we know what his aspirations are?
Well, as Nick Ames wrote, he's got a job for life at Östersund, but sooner or later, surely you think he would want to try it over here and kind of show people that he can succeed with his methods. And I think he could. I mean, maybe not Sunderland, because no one seems to be able to succeed there, but maybe at a stable championship club. And I really hope he gets a chance, maybe when the Europa League adventure is finished, whenever that is, in the spring or so, and surely he could do a good job here.
I think one English club has thought of him, and it's your club, it's Swansea.
Really?
Yep. I think it's a relationship that goes back quite a long time, but I think they're the only club which have expressed an interest in him. And
does he play the Swansea way?
No. The rumor goes that at one point he was somebody who was in contention
prior to Paul Clement.
Possibly, to be honest, Swansea fans have told that to me, so
I didn't know
I trust them.
And would he fit the football they play?
Wouldn't you like to give a chance to a man like that? That's what I was saying for, you know, West Ham never. And then one particular problem would be at West Ham would be the multilingual nature of the dressing room, and the fact that when I say multilingual, the presence of players who don't speak English well enough. Whereas I'm sure at Östersund everybody speaks perfect English, like all Swedes do. But you could imagine a team like Everton, which is much more homogeneous. Why wouldn't it work? I don't know.
Does he have complete autonomy? Because
Pretty much.
Yeah, I feel that with the Swans, there's a too many cooks element. I think there are seven men who are in charge of recruitment, and that is why we've never played our record signing.
I like they all come in on the same day going, I've bought us a number 10. Actually, must be Everton as well, mustn't it? Since you're here, Marcus, Sweden, Italy, are you optimistic?
A little bit. I think we'll probably draw at home and lose bravely away.
Okay. But so not that optimistic.
Well, I've given ourselves a 30% chance to win. It's a good Sweden team, actually, hardworking, and I think they can create a few problems for Italy. Without Zlatan, we've lost our stardust, but you look at the Italy team as well, and you think they've lost their stardust as well, actually. So they're two... I mean, they've got better players than us, but I think we've beaten France at home. We could cause them some problems.
And is failure to qualify in Sweden, is that a sort of day of mourning, or are you a bit more relaxed about?
No, it's fine. This new coach, Jan Andersson, has really got the nation behind him, so to speak, so the tickets sold out in minutes kind of thing. So it'd be great atmosphere on Friday at Friends Arena. And even if they lose, they got probably the toughest playoff draw. And, I mean, it's a funny team. They got good players, but they've also got Seb Larsson dominating midfield, central midfield. So that kind of puts into perspective of where we are. We've got Ola Toivonen and Marcus Berg up front. They're not world beaters, but together they play really well, and played well against France away, and should probably have got a point there as well. So there's hope.
Is there anyone else who would rather see Sweden than Italy, or are you in a sort of purist sense saying it can't be a World Cup without Italy in it?
They haven't not qualified since 1958. So for that reason, I would like Italy to not qualify.
Good.
I don't mind. I can't conceive of a World Cup without Italy in it, but, you know, if Sweden beat them fair and square, then, tough.
Absolutely.
Marcus, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
You may leave and do some football editing. let's move on to the other games. Northern Ireland, Switzerland. Stephen Davis' 100th game, which is worth mentioning for anyone who manages to get 100 caps, is quite extraordinary. And the pressure on him, given how few Premier League players there are in that Northern Ireland team.
And Aaron Hughes is missing, isn't he, as well?
Mm-hmm.
He's a very important player for them.
So I just wanted to say, sort of congratulate Stephen Davis.
The last time Northern Ireland played Switzerland in a competitive match was also a World Cup qualifier. George Best and Pat Jennings were playing.
Wow.
Oof. They don't have players of that quality anymore, but they have a remarkable team spirit.
I mean, they haven't qualified since 86. It would be such a fantastic achievement for Michael O'Neill.
Yeah, well,
and he is a great man.
It's already, he's achieved, that's it. It's already just getting there, is achievement enough? Yes, absolutely. And again, how long is it going to be before somebody gets seriously interested in Michael O'Neill as a club manager?
Well, Michael O'Neill kind of reminds me a bit of listening to the story of Graham Potter, I thought of Michael O'Neill because he kind of made a name for himself managing Shamrock Rovers in Ireland, qualified them for the Europa League. They got tonked in the group stages. They played Spurs. You know, I don't know if you remember, but you know, that was a big adventure, big deal for a League of Ireland club to make it to the group stages of European competition. And now he's at the Northern Ireland job. Yeah, would he? It is a gamble to give a guy like that with not much pedigree a big job in the Championship or Premier League, but I think a gamble worth taking.
The Swiss got leapfrogged by Portugal, didn't they?
Yeah, they won everything before that game, yeah.
So, I mean, I hate to bring my own football podcast into this, but talking to actual footballers, it's extraordinary the difference that can make in terms of momentum and confidence. They're so fragile, footballers. And I just think that...
You're right, because I've heard that and I've sort of brushed that off as just a cliche that people say, well, they'll be sad they lost. I mean,
For 25 years, when pundits used to say on telly, oh, they're going to be buzzing, they're going to be confident going into the game, I used to think, you're saying that because you haven't got anything decent to say. But that is actually makes a massive difference because when teams lose, the whole atmosphere on the club or the squad is black.
And it's a team which has also got its internal problems, Switzerland. It's a team that is not remarkable by its togetherness. I mean, it's not talks. I mean, it's well known that there are basically two camps. The people who are the real Swiss and the people who are come from, you know, from the immigration. And that as soon as things don't go quite as well as they should, as that, you know, you can imagine that this difference becomes something more important than that. And I know it's a tricky subject, isn't it?
Yeah.
And but people talk about it very openly in Switzerland as being something which needs to be addressed. And
but they find, cliques happen in international football for other reasons as well, don't they? I mean, and it always seems strange. Dean Ashton it speaks really well about how when he went, there were four or five England players that didn't talk to him. I mean, that just seems so weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
It just seems totally bizarre.
It's childish.
It's really childish. It's almost unbelievable.
You would think that you would go out of your way to make newcomers to the squad welcome. It's just a natural human thing to do.
You made Ellis a coffee.
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. It would be totally weird.
He made me a coffee and I appreciated the eye contact.
Yeah. On that Potter thing, I'm just nervous that if he does get a job in the Premier League, the number of Harry Potter-based newspaper headlines that there'll be, that it's almost worth him not getting the job.
English managers who succeed in Europe are always seen as a crazy curiosity by the English press. So you'd see these articles about Roy Hodgson when he was doing well in Europe, and they'd always start, but they'd say things like, you know, if I told you that the Inter Milan manager, current Inter Milan caretaker manager, was tactically astute, you'd think, okay, but if I told you that he was English... Because Hodgson speaks five languages.
And reads books.
Yeah, his friends are just fascinated by that.
Forgetting, of course, that England was an incredible exporter of managers until not that long ago.
Yeah, good point.
You know, and the perhaps inventor of total football is an Englishman. Vic Buckingham came from Tottenham and to Ajax, discovered Cruyff and started... and started the ball rolling.
But we also invented 4-4-2, hit the channels, put it in the mixer.
Well, that's perfect. Nothing wrong with 4-4-2,
hit the
channels.
I
like 4-4-2 because I understand it.
Denmark versus the Republic of Ireland. Hey, Barry, I found the Danish Barry. Lars Bogegaard wrote a piece in The Guardian, just a little preview with a sort of your sort of optimistic tone. He says, there doesn't seem to be much between the teams. I expect two very physical games. Think we'll be held to a goalless draw at home before losing 1-0 in the away leg. What's your thoughts?
I probably say he's hit the nail on the head there.
But you presumably think the other way around.
It's a coin toss, I think. They're two quite similar teams. Physical, direct. Ellis has experienced firsthand the magnificence of Ireland striking with the power of 10,000 suns on their trip to Cardiff, but we won't talk about that.
Ellis, I saw you quite soon after that game and you were very down. How are you now?
Well, I'm considering going to watch Dulwich Hamlet
okay.
as a kind of palate cleanser.
Okay. As I said, he want to go pretty quickly because they may not exist in a month's time.
I will watch the game with a morbid curiosity because I would have quite fancied Wales against Denmark, to be honest. However, I will back Ireland because I think Martin O'Neill is incredible in these shootout situations. He just gets, I mean, it's such a cliche, but he just gets it done. And I think Ireland will qualify.
I don't think so.
Because Christian Eriksen, well, he's a key, isn't he?
So yeah, there's a slight difference between the two teams. I don't think
they just set up so well.
I know.
It's so hard to beat. And it's so attritional and horrible to watch.
Yes,
yeah. These will not be good games of football to watch for a neutral.
I went to Dublin. I went to the qualifier in Dublin, the 0-0 when Seamus Coleman broke his neck. What a terrible game of football that was.
Yeah, and you know Denmark are not an attractive team to watch. They have good players, obviously. They have Nicholas Bentner.
Lord Bentner, still there. Knocking them in.
Christian Eriksen. Thomas Delaney, yes. Who sounds Irish but isn't. Kasper Schmeichel. Andreas Christensen, the Chelsea central defender. Looks like he'll
Simon
come in.
Kjær, who's a very good player.
Because Denmark have got quite a few injuries. Whereas I think Ireland's only significant absentee is... David Myler, who's suspended. But Ireland also have 10 players who are one yellow card away from suspension for the second leg, which
so they might have no players. 10 bookings, and that was it, just play with a keeper.
He's one of the coaches. Yeah,
right. Is it just James McLean? An amazing.
No, James McLean is one of them.
Well, I'm unsurprised.
But incidentally, we never mentioned his tackle last Saturday.
Oh, the insanity of it.
Oh.
I
like James McLean, and I love how annoyed imbeciles get about the fact that he won't wear a poppy. And I just the fact that he makes those kind of people so angry. endears him to me, but God almighty, he is a walking
he's a maniac,
red card.
Isn't he? Yeah. I mean, that's it. And obviously he's done it so many times that it's a bit like that Andy Carroll sending off in a, you know, when he sets off from like 200 yards away and you think, well, he's not really going to do that.
Oh yes, he is.
Well, yeah. James McLean's the same, isn't he? That there's just and I imagine a pundit would say, and I don't know if this is, I always think this is something that doesn't make any sense. They go, well, if you can't take that out of his game, the sort of wild two-footed lunges from 200 yards away, because then he'd be less of a player.
Well, he'd be on the pitch.
Well, exactly. But he gets away with it quite a lot, doesn't he?
I'm not sure I agree. But everyone says that. So I think, well, I'm not going to be the one lone voice who says, isn't that nonsense?
Well, I think it's not. Surely it's nonsense.
Well, he's one of those that you basically cannot take that away from his game, because you would say that's his game anyway. It's very different from Graham Souness, who just did, I mean, the tackles, which were even more horrific than that. But it was completely willingly, and he wanted to do these tackles. Something takes over James McLean and you know, I don't know, there's a guy in remote control say, well, okay, let's press the button now. And it's a red button. And the red mist descends.
I always think with Graham Souness, when I look at him, he really looks like the kind of person who could ruin Christmas Day. Like, if your parents in law are over, it's been really nice. Everyone's opened their presents and he's just said something absolutely horrible. He's gone in two-footed on Gran. She's been upended next to the Welsh dresser.
He's also to balance this.
And then
this
he stood
portrait.
Over Gran as well, hasn't he? He stood over and gone like this. Yeah. Do you want more?
Send it together.
To balance this portrait of James McLean, he's also has earned the reputation of being one of the most generous footballers that there are, and somebody who does an awful, awful lot of very good work indeed, and very discreetly.
Good.
It should be said.
I'm glad you said that.
Okay.
Andrew says, if Ireland qualify, can Barry's chair be made into a throne?
I'm amenable.
If Ireland lose, will Barry give up his chair to Max as a forfeit?
No. Well, you can have my chair, you just can't have my spot at the table.
I don't want your spot at the table.
Yeah, well, I've no great affinity for the chair. I'd sit on a tea chest, but I have to sit at this particular...
Okay. I really hoped Ellis sat in your chair to see what would happen. Jackie Oatley once put her bag there.
There
were ructions.
The scenes.
Absolutely right. Red Reed and Patrick McGinley ask a similar based question, which is basically, should the islands come together? I'm sure it's a question that's been asked a million times before, as they do in rugby and cricket and boxing, apparently. Would they pool their resources? Or is it just history is now what it is?
Well, the thing is, it's a kind of a... most people think that there's the FAI, the Football Association of Ireland, the one in the Republic, and the Irish Football Association, the one in the North, are separate entities because of the partition. And that's not the case. They were separate before the six counties became the six counties and, you know, all that was sorted out. And it was over a row... Leinster in the south of Ireland thought that there was a biasness in favour of Ulster teams, so there was a split, and it's nothing to do with the whole politics of the situation. Okay. So that's a misconception. I think that it has been talked about. No one's particularly keen. I don't think anyone's emphatically against it. There was a time it was being seriously considered, and I think in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a game between Linfield and Donegal Celtic, Linfield being the Belfast team, Donegal Celtic, and it was really marred by terrible violence. And then there was the famous game between Ireland and Northern Ireland in Windsor Park, where Ireland qualified for the Euros, but that was toxic. Before that, in the mid to late 70s, it was being considered, and then the troubles broke out, so that put a stop to that. But I think, you know, various Irish government ministers called for it. A lot of senior Irish players, you know, now retired, have called for it. The players all get on with each other fine.
I sort of think you just have two all right, one all right international football team as opposed to two.
I don't think there's enough enthusiasm for it. And plus, quite a lot of Northern Irish Protestants wouldn't want anything to do with an All-Ireland team. I think I could be wrong, but I have a feeling quite a lot of them wouldn't want to be involved. There is a bit of bad blood there as well, because as part of the Good Friday Agreement, anyone born in Northern Ireland can choose to be a citizen of the Republic. And because of that, there's a feeling in Northern Ireland, and plenty of justification for this feeling, that the Republic are poaching players who would otherwise be Northern Irish, James McLean being a case in point.
Okay. The other game is Croatia-Greece.
The Greeks have a good record of qualifying for international tournaments, and for a country of 10 million people, I'm always quite impressed by that. You know,
And they're on an upwards curve, because at the start of the qualification campaign, it was pretty poor.
Greece are on their way back from having hit rock bottom. Euro 2006 qualification, they finished bottom of the group, lost twice against Faroe Islands. So I suspect just being in this playoff is a huge relief for them. They've gone back to basics again. This watching Greece play is an ordeal, as it was when they won in Euro 2004.
Good grief,
but
yes,
it worked. And I don't think they will beat Croatia, but I don't think it will matter a huge amount to Greeks. They're just happy not to be bottom of the group and a complete laughing stock.
There are other playoffs as well around the world. Let's start in Honduras, which is where Australia are. They play the first leg on Friday. To give us some insight into this, we're joined by Australian football writer Kieran Pender. How are you doing, Kieran?
Yeah, good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. How are Australia looking going into this game? I watched the Thailand game, and I watched the second leg of the Syria game, and they were four of the most boring hours of my entire life.
Which you will never get back.
Which I'll never get back. I don't know how are Australia setting up ahead of this game?
Yeah, I think all of Australia are pretty nervous. Australia has a history of these do or die, you know, Intercontinental World Cup qualifiers, and those games are things of nightmares for Socceroos fans. You know, Iran in 1997, Australia almost qualified, Uruguay in 2001, and then famously when the Socceroos beat Uruguay in 2005, John Aloisi scored an iconic penalty. So that sort of history looms large, I suppose, and it doesn't help that the first leg is in San Pedro Sula in Honduras. I don't think it's a particularly hospitable atmosphere, you know, the heat, the local crowd. It'll be an interesting first leg.
Kieran, I believe with their usual skill at diplomatic relations, a couple of Australians have managed to offend the entire population of Honduras ahead of the game, thus ensuring a less than hospitable atmosphere.
Yes, and that's why I chose my words carefully there. So Tim Cahill, you know, famous Australian forward, was on a TV show, and the host asked him some slightly tinged questions. San Pedro Sula used to be the murder city of the world, murder capital of the world. Cahill played it with a fairly straight bat, but that the questions that were asked of him and some of the hysteria around that made its way over to Honduran newspapers, and apparently there's been outrage, allegations of racism, etc. So I think they'll certainly not have won themselves many fans.
You mentioned that amazing game against Uruguay, and I watched it back. I can't remember. I think I was interviewing Mark Schwartz or something, and it is an amazing moment when Aloisi scores that penalty, and you're sort of looking for a hero now for Australia, and Tim Cahill is extraordinary, you know, how he's still going. He's got fitness concerns, hasn't he? And he is key, and I guess him and Aaron Moy seem the absolute keys for you.
Yeah, so Cahill is obviously a legend of Australian football, and the fact he's still going, you know, he scored some crucial goals in that game against Syria. Despite his age, you know, a young 37, he's still going strong. He rolled his ankle in a clash in an A-League game for Melbourne City last week. And so that sort of put the Australian footballing community, you know, on the edge of their seat. Will he? Won't he? He delayed his flight. He's in Honduras now. He's warmed up with the team, and you know the rumours are he will play. Whether he starts, he may be left on the bench and brought on. Aaron Moy, for club level, you know, for Huddersfield has been a real standout in the last few years. At the national team level, hasn't quite clicked. Kim and Tom Rogic from Celtic, the Frank Lampard, Steven Gerrard conundrum, you know, for Australia, that they're two very impressive midfielders but have never been able to click together. And so actually, potentially the key player for Australia for this game is Mile Jednak, you know, former Crystal Palace captain, is playing at Aston Villa now, hasn't played much this season through injury. And Villa actually allowed the Australian national team physio to spend a few weeks in Birmingham with him, preparing him so he'd be right for this game.
Listen, Kieran, appreciate you coming on. Thanks so much, and good luck to the Aussies.
Thanks.
Cheers, Kieran. Kieran Pender there, Australian football writer. And good luck to the Hondurans as well, we should say.
Absolutely.
For balance.
Come on, Honduras.
I presume the future Mrs. Russian will be glued to the TV.
That's why she flew back to Australia. So she could be with her people. I would put money on the fact she has literally no idea that this football match is taking place. She probably doesn't even know. She won't know there's a World Cup in next year. She won't
right,
know.
Okay.
Funny fact about Honduras.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's not funny. It's not a funny fact, the fact that they actually, most of them are based in Honduras, which is already quite interesting. Mm-hmm. But also, I would support Honduras for many reasons, but they've got a player who is called Boniek. And because his parents, obviously, thought that Boniek was a fantastic player, so he's called Boniek, and he's the record... As a first name. It was his middle name, which has become his first name now. Oh. Everybody calls him Boniek. Hmm. Boniek Garcia.
See, his parents named him after a famous footballer in the hope that...
It worked.
My dad named me after a famous Welsh out half. That didn't really work out.
Is it Barry John?
He went to school with my dad.
Did he?
Yeah.
New Zealand, Peru. I've actually got a lot of stick in the comment section for writing off New Zealand. So I hope they do it.
They're 122nd in the world rankings. Peru are 10th. Mm. New Zealand having a hope.
Yeah, but the rankings don't mean anything, do they, Barry?
Once again, I'm trying to not get stick for saying.
Well, I'll take the heat.
Well, Barry's going to take the stick this time.
As we mentioned last time, when they went to the World Cup and they drew all their games in the group, they released a DVD called Undefeated.
<That's beautiful.
laughs> So for that, which is, I'd love to watch that DVD.
I was just checking the rankings yesterday. I for this very purpose, where were Peru? Where I had no idea Peru were so high, and I had no idea New Zealand were so low. So maybe it's just the quality of opposition they play or something.
I've got a soft spot for New Zealand because if you're a New Zealand football fan, I just think to choose football over rugby makes you a special kind of person. I did stand-up in New Zealand. I did a tour of New Zealand. And they're, when you meet a New Zealand football fan, they're like missionaries. Because, you know, the whole they've got an entire culture that's against them. I really hope New Zealand qualify. I think it'd be great.
So you hate Peru, is what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. I'll put that out there. I don't mind.
My parents nearly got kidnapped in Peru.
Didn't they?
Yeah.
I once got held up for hours in a Peruvian town. They wouldn't. There was a strike, and we were on a bus going through Peru.
Do we have listeners in Peru? Because you're going to get stick for
them. No, I don't. I was in Peru. We were on a bus. And first of all, these farmers were on strike. And they'd basically ripped up a bridge. So they'd taken up, this was like a wooden bridge. And they'd just ripped all the wooden slats off the bridge.
Oh, Welsh farmers were doing that in the 1840s.
So then we had to rebuild the bridge with other people who wanted to get across the bridge, getting the wooden slats and putting them on. And then like, one truck went across and we all cheered. And there were some Peruvians who were angry with us because they didn't want us.
So you're a scab? Well, you're a Peruvian scab.
Listen, I didn't vote for strike action. So like, I wasn't officially, I wasn't claiming any wages. Anyway, our bus was the one that went along when the slats gave way, right? And so then
how far was the drop?
Oh, about 30 feet. Anyway, so it fell through the wood onto like the metals. And we had to spend 2 hours jacking the bloody bus up to get it across the wood. Eventually we got through, and then we got to this town where basically they said you can't go through. And we were like, all right, well, we're just in this town. So we just got a football and played with all the children, and it brought everyone together.
Like a humanitarian.
Exactly right. Yeah. It's the end of my Peruvian anecdote.
That is why I will never, ever go travelling.
Producer Mel says, ask Barry about his parents. Oh, yeah, why did they get kidnapped?
Well, it's one of those con jobs, you know, where a bloke dressed as a policeman, but who wasn't a policeman, attempted to... I actually can't remember the nitty-gritty, the details. I just remember my mother telling me the story of how they nearly got kidnapped.
Okay. Well, maybe 1 week on a pod special, we'll get Mrs. Glendenning in.
No, we won't.
Okay. To Africa, there are still places available. They're still in the group stages. Tunisia can take top spot in Group A if they manage a single point against Libya, who are bottom of their group. The Ivory Coast need to beat Morocco away to overtake them in Group C and qualify. In Group D, Senegal have to take at least 2 points from their two matches against South Africa if they are to reach Russia. All right, that'll do for part two. In part three, we'll get excited about England's friendly with Germany. Welcome back to part three, Guardian Football Weekly Extra. England play Germany. Hey, before that, Philippe, where were you last night?
I was on the Holloway Road at the Odeon for a star-studded occasion, which was the premiere of 89, a film, a documentary devoted to the single greatest match in the history of soccer, which is, of course, Arsenal's 2-0 victory. Over
Liverpool. Tell us what happens.
Sorry about that. I can tell you, when you watch the film, you really wonder. it's absolutely magnificent. I don't think you need to be a gooner to appreciate it at all. It's really a terrific film.
Amazing. Just a great moment in football.
A magnificent moment in football and very well told.
I'm not an Arsenal fan, but I think that is the most extraordinary moment in the history of top-flight English football. I think it's... I actually watch it quite regularly, because I think it's genuinely amazing. So I will watch that film. And as a little kid, I had a soft spot for, I was a Liverpool fan because of Ian Rush. So, you know, I should dismiss it, really. But good grief. It's everything. It's the context of it being a fortnight after Hillsborough. Yeah. And hadn't Liverpool not lost for 7 years at Anfield or something? But certainly by more than two goals.
Arsenal had lost to Derby, drawn against Wimbledon.
Wimbledon, yeah.
Yeah, so...
But John Barnes just take it into the corner and then there's no documentary.
That's right.
Alan Smith's touch is underrated as well for the goal, isn't it? I mean, fabulous. It's a glorious touch.
Absolutely glorious touch. And of course he said, because he was there, of
he's
course.
He's a great guy, Smudge.
He's a wonderful guy. And modest as ever, but he only scored the goal and provided a fantastic assist.
And the
2-0 victory.
Wow. And the fact that it's not like the Aguero... you know, moment. It's the fact that the teams who could both win the league were playing each other in the final game of the season. I can't think of another example of that.
No.
So, I just think it's... I will watch that film. But then again, I've read Robbie Savage's autobiography, so maybe I don't have a critical faculty.
Was it good?
I've read it twice.
Do you get the hidden meanings the second time?
Yeah. It's, he's quite a metaphysical guy, Robbie Savage. He's quite a deep thinker. There's a very interesting bit in it where...
Why are you laughing back?
There's quite an interesting bit in it where...
He talks
about being made to have... when he was in the reserves at Man United, he was made to have sex with a woman made out of coat hangers.
Oh, that's quite a painful.
Yeah, no, well, Ooh. She was... She, so it was the coat hanger provided the shoulder, then it was the mop was the hair.
Mm-hmm.
And then they put the mop and the coat hanger on a treatment table, and then they turned the light on and off to imply that it was at a discotheque.
Like a strobe,
yeah. And All then right. he had to show the other players what his moves were. Huh. But there's a great line where he says, I was a virgin at the time, so I was scared that my sex noises were wrong.
God. Do you want to tell your Robbie Savage story, Barry?
Not really. No. That anecdote, which I was unfamiliar with, yeah. Normally in one of those hazing rituals, you feel sorry for the person being hazed. In this, I feel sorry for the woman made out of coat and a mop.
England played Germany. A lot of players have pulled out of the squad through injury, which is a shame. Barney Roney wrote a piece about how basically Southgate, and I totally agree with him, Southgate should just play as many Spurs players as he can in the World Cup because, Dier and Henderson, I don't know who's better, but so you might as well go with Dier because he knows Harry Winks, Jack Wilshere, you know, who's fit and who isn't, but you might as well play Winks, and then you play Ali and Kane, and then you build the rest around. Kyle Walker's basically still a Spurs player. Rose might get fit. That gives you a chance, but now there's no...
Play Trippier, for goodness sake.
Would you play Trippier over Walker? Yeah. So then, but there's no point in doing that. There's no point... in having the friendly now for that reason, because none of them are there.
No.
Well, Wink, Sally and Kane.
So are six are out now, or has the list grown since last time I
had? I think it's seven.
I think it's seven. Would you pick, Jack Cork's been brought in. Would you have picked Wilshere over Cork? Because who's more likely to actually be at the World Cup? Or is that not the
it's
right
It's more a
way
question of which kind of role would, will Jack Cork fulfil, and is a, defensive-minded player. Oh, actually, excellent quality, by the way, who perhaps has gone a bit off the radar. When he was at Southampton, people were talking about him as a future England international, and since then it's been a bit iffy. But Wilshere offers something completely different. And where would you put Wilshere? I mean, he's a number 10, isn't he?
Could you play him in a two in front of the back four? I don't know. I think other interesting things is that it looks like Jack Butland will get the goalkeeper's jersey for both games. Danny Rose has been saying some interesting things about just what it's like for a footballer to be injured for so long. And I actually, until I did my knee, right, and have been out for a year, never really paid any attention to footballers going, I missed 9 months. And it's their job as well, but like how boring rehab is, how difficult it must be to go into a, especially Spurs when they're successful and you're not part of it.
9 months is probably over 5% of your career, of your whole career.
Yeah,
they feel
totally excluded as well. Mm. And I think they get mixed up with feelings of jealousy and also you want your team to win, but the player has replaced you, you don't want him to do particularly well. And they'll be ignored by some managers. I think it's a real fault of man management in football, in that if you're injured, you're kind of persona non grata, which I don't think is very helpful, because feeling negative is not going to help you.
That's what happened to David Rocastle at the end of his career, when he was regularly injured and his managers didn't behave perhaps as they should have.
On that score, do you think then, say with England, Southgate should have kind of insisted, say, look, the England medical team is decent, so if you're injured... come, be at St George's Park, have dinner with us.
Which is, by the way, what the French do sometimes. That the players, the club say they're injured, say, well, you still have to come.
Hmm.
You still have to come. I mean, obviously not if the guy's just broken a leg or something like that. But if it's, there has to be a diagnosis done by the French team, medical team. But why not? Absolutely. The other thing I was wondering, if you've got loads of players like this dropping out, instead of asking... players like Livermore and Cork, maybe it's a little bit controversial, I'm going to say, what about these young players who've been winning everything all through the year? Why not take this opportunity to bring them in?
Well, that's, like a Phil Foden.
They're world champions. That's what Wales
will do. because we have a very good youth team, but they will all get given an opportunity. So I would like to think that Ampadu will make an appearance against Panama probably on Tuesday night, because
well done.
Yeah, we're excited about our teenagers, because talking to people who watch a lot of Welsh youth football, everyone's very excited about Bale and Ramsey and Allen, but apparently our crop of 16, 17, 18 year olds are better than they were at that age. But they will play, because if you're good enough, you're old enough, as far as we're concerned.
Absolutely.
VAR is being used at Wembley. How's it gone down so far in Europe? We haven't really touched on it too much on the pod so far.
It's a mixed bag. At the moment, VAR is used in six countries in the world. In the US, in Argentina, and it's used in the Netherlands, Italy, Germany and Portugal. And there have been a few problems in Italy, but and also in Germany. We all know about the problems. We don't know about the times when it actually goes right. There are still mistakes being made, and the studies which have been done since the introduction, which is honestly very recent, but seem to indicate that about one game in 10 has been adversely affected by the use of VAR, which is a very high proportion. And one of the reasons is not the technology in itself, is the fact that the referees are not properly trained in the use of VAR yet, which is understandable. You need time for people to learn how to use it, which means that when it comes to the World Cup in 2018, because, of course, Infantino wants to push his baby forward, it's, you know, the technology is fine, but will we have the number of referees we need who are proficient enough?
Sorry, how do you need to be trained to go over to a video screen and check if you made the right decision or not and go back?
Well, you have to. Reading a video is not as obvious as it seems. I mean, also, what do you ask? Also, it's the communication between who is in the room upstairs and the referee, who has the last word. There's all these sort of things. And at the moment, there are still questions. Like, for example, I'm looking at the some mistakes which have happened. Like, for example, in the Sporting Braga in Portugal just a few days ago, Fran Sergio scored for Braga and was signalled offside wrongly. But the referee had whistled just before the ball went in, so the goal couldn't stand. So, and you think, okay, that's a tough one. So referees have got to get used to how to use it. So for example,
how long to play the advantage.
For example, here he thought, it's marginal, you know, I should play on, and then we can check whether he was offside or not. In this case, he whistled too quickly, and the guy was denied a perfectly decent goal.
Barry, you lead the charge for saying VAR is a terrible idea. Is that correct?
Well, I've always been against it. I'd never thought there was any need for it. Plenty of people in this podcast used to more or less ridicule me for having that view and make out it was some sort of Luddite living in the Stone Age. James Richardson and I used to have very heated debates about VAR. He couldn't see why on earth you wouldn't use it if it's available. But the introduction so far, and it is early stages, but it's been an absolute shambles, a disaster. Refs don't know how to use it properly. Decisions are still being got wrong. Fans and players don't know what's going on when it's referred to. It takes too long. You have the classic case at the Confederations Cup last year. Chile playing Germany. Gonzalo Jara elbowed Timo Werner in the face. Ref didn't spot it. It was brought up, sent up to the TV guy. Took 3 minutes to reach a decision on a fairly straightforward matter. Did he elbow him or not? Is it a red card or not? In the end, the ref decided, yeah, he did elbow him, but I'm only giving him a yellow. So A, that's a wrong decision. B, it's not. It's there to judge red card. Is it a red card or not a red card? Not, is it something in the middle? So that was one classic example of where everything that could possibly go wrong did go wrong. The crowd had no idea what was going on. Gonzalo Jara clearly had the look about him of a man who I am going to be sent off, and then couldn't believe his luck when the yellow came out. So I'm not saying abandon it completely, but in its current state, it does not work. I've seen people argue that, you know, I think actually I've seen you argue, Philippe, that in its early stages, cricket VAR didn't work.
Yes, correct.
And
yes.
Is now good. But the thing about cricket is you either hit the ball or you didn't, you know, so you're in or you're out. In football, a lot of the decisions are far more subjective.
Absolutely.
So how one ref views an incident on the screen or interprets it will differ from another. So I just think it's supposed to add clarity. It doesn't. It adds more confusion. So why bother with
it? The fact that some of the VAR decisions are still contentious or have been proven to be incorrect shows that it's not the cure-all panacea that everyone thought it would be. That's the thing that I was actually against it as well. That said, I have a suspicion that in 10 years' time, when it's been introduced, we won't be able to believe that it was ever a debate because it's an experiment for a year to iron out these kinks. And in the same way that we don't have golden goal anymore because it wasn't a very good idea, I think it will change and I think it will adapt. But, you know, the laws of football are far more subjective than other sports. So I just, you know, I'm not too sure.
They sort of need to, do they need to mic up the, because, you know, in other sports, I know they stop and start. You have that cricket, it's exciting. It's a part of the game when you're like, ooh, you see the replay.
But cricket lasts 5 days.
Yeah, that's true.
The interesting thing I read in Serie A is that players are committing fewer fouls, apparently. And also they aren't bombarding the referee in the same way that they used to because they kind of think, well, the camera doesn't lie.
Even though there have been loads of problems in Serie A, including quite a number of games when VAR actually the system broke down.
Someone didn't press record on the VHS like that.
It's happened in quite a few games, which is a bit embarrassing. But if you talk to the fans, and I know the Gazzetta is has got a running story about it, the fans who were dubious are now massively in favour of VAR. The referees themselves obviously are for it. As Alice said, there's been an improvement in the behaviour of the players as well. Everybody seems now to be in favour and understanding that, yeah, it's going to take time to iron out a few problems. But on the other hand, there was an example at the very beginning of Serie A this season, which was in the game, it's Milan against Sampdoria, when the penalty was given for a handball by Frank Kessier in the first minute of the game. So it was a really, really important decision. And the referee thought, oh, actually, not too sure about this. And can I check the video? He checked the video. The hand was very clearly actually against the body. There's no movement. Penalty was actually cancelled. So that was very positive. I can't see how you can possibly argue against that. It's just fairness and justice.
The improvement in player behaviour was something I would never have foreseen from VAR.
Yeah.
And that's quite exciting because it's not a pleasant aspect of the game. And if players do behave slightly more admirably because of it, then I think, you know, that's something that I'm in favour of.
The guy in charge of VAR
in Germany
has just been sacked.
Mm-hmm. He has.
It was alleged he gave two decisions, contentious decisions, in favour of Schalke, who he supports, in a game against Wolfsburg. A charge he emphatically denies, it should be said. And I don't suppose there's any way you can prove whether it was a biased decision or not. But
surely he just shouldn't be doing the Schalke game. Anyway. I mean,
that's what you'd have thought.
Total madness. I mean, I suppose the real problem with VAR is humans are still involved.
Yeah, it's as good as the humans we use in the technology. I like the idea of him sat there in a Schalke scarf.
Can I get away with this? Suddenly it's a penalty to the opposition and they march it all the way up the other end and no one knows what's going on.
Big rosette.
We asked for a big Q&A. Barry did on Tuesday when he thought it was Wednesday and he got his days muddled up and was nervous that no one had done any prep for this podcast a day early. What did you do with your extra day, Barry?
Well, it's depressing because today is Thursday, but in my head it's Friday.
Yeah.
So, but it isn't Friday. So tomorrow.
And you only live for the weekend, Barry, don't you?
Hard five.
Those were the days. Oh. This is like the pre-game international break. International break podcast is always like just tumbleweed.
Glenn Denning's
is that your review
approach? It's an illusion. Yeah. He's like a duck. He's frantically doing a lot of prep, but away from prying eyes. It's all part of brand Glenn Denning.
How would you market brand Glenn Denning, Ellis?
Well, he's you can't market him, and that's how you'd market him.
I see. He's always rogue.
Like that film Arthur. Is it with Dudley Moore?
No.
Doesn't he go into advertising? I mean, is that what it's called? Maybe. He goes into advertising, but he's just very honest about his products. But it's been a long time since then. He was a staple of ITV in the early 90s. So
when I was watching Murder, She Wrote, loop on that. That's a great one when Tom Selleck's in as Magnum and they solve a crime together. but he flirts a bit with Angela Lansbury, which doesn't feel right.
They clearly only had a very limited amount of time together.
Yeah.
So all their interacting with each other was done, you know, he was behind bars, obviously for a crime he didn't commit, and she was trying to, you know, get him out of the frame. But so they clearly could only find like a 2-hour window where both Selleck and Lansbury were available.
My friend Lloyd pointed out that Murder, She Wrote and Smashing Pumpkins are the same font.
So we are, Barry asked lots of questions. They got some really good questions. We've just been going on for so long, haven't we? I like this one. Barry doesn't, but you can humour me and we'll keep it in if it's good. Luke Freeman says, if you could make a Frankenstein footballer of footballers' best parts, what would they be? Messi's left foot, Llorente's face.
Branislav Ivanovic's bottom.
You would go Ivanovic's bottom.
Oh, he's got absolutely
balls
extraordinary.
Balls of steel.
Kenny Dalglish had a big bum.
Did he?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I would take Shaqiri's calves. Are you drawing this, Baz?
Yeah.
So we agreed on Messi's left foot?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so then right foot.
Ivanovic, backside.
I see Michel Platini.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
In the Guardian orbit of Ferenc Puskas, one of his Real Madrid teammates said his left foot was so good, it was more like a hand.
Oh, right. So what, we could put Puskas's left foot on the left hand?
Yeah.
To get it in.
Mark Hughes' thighs.
Do you think his? Because I think I thought maybe we wanted somewhat a quad with real pace.
No, I've given it.
John Charles' barrel chest.
Okay. It's going very well, Shannon.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
Paul Bowden's moustache.
Ledley's beard. Mark Hughes' sort of Celtic face carved by the sea.
No, I would take Llorente's face, but with Tim Cahill's forehead for the heading. Maybe.
What, because Llorente is not very good at heading?
Well, he's not as good as Cahill, is he? For his, you know.
I would say he is.
What about the hair?
Graziano Pella?
Valderrama.
Okay. they're different looks, aren't they, I suppose. Shaqiri's calves, Okazaki's smile.
Did you Drogba's chest?
Drogba's chest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You could have Donald Trump's tiny hands to just sort of decrease the chances of handling the ball.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
that's true.
Billy Wright's hair. Because you don't see hair like that anymore.
No, that's true.
If you look at that England team from the 50s, they all had a kind of hair that has died out.
Do you want Valderrama's hair with Billy Wright's parting?
I'm trying to think of a footballer with good cheekbones.
Oh, well.
Edinson Cavani.
So listen, thanks for all your questions. I'm going to end it there, but producer Mel says we have to ask Ellis and Philippe about Wales, France, and Chris Coleman. And we're in no hurry, by the way. I wouldn't want you to feel rushed here. Coleman says he's going to stay, wants to stay. Is that what you want, Ellis?
I would love Coleman to stay. The negotiations have taken a while. They're going to resume after this set of games. He is perennially linked with Premier League jobs. I
can't understand why.
Well, I mean, I think we probably have different opinions on Chris Coleman, but I certainly for Wales, I think he's our greatest manager of all. Him or Jimmy Murphy, but I think when you look at what he's achieved, I don't think you can doubt that. And we've had great squads of players in the past. Like that team in 93 that didn't qualify for USA 94, you had Rush and Hughes and Speed and Giggs and Southall. You know, that team was probably better on paper than his current side. But he got us to the semi-finals of the European Championships. We qualified for the first time in years. I would love him to stay. Also, the players are desperate for him to stay. They're meeting after we lost to Ireland. They all, including Gareth Bale, apparently, they went in and begged him to stay on. But, who knows?
I always thought because England went out against Iceland and that was total humiliation, that's what the media focused on, that Wales didn't get quite enough credit for getting to the semi-final of the Euros. But I also think now, after getting to the semi-final of the Euros, they've got nowhere near enough criticism for not finishing in the top two in what should have been, for European semi-finalists, a very straightforward group.
Losing to Ireland, that was the first time we'd gone behind in the group. I mean, we only lost one game. I mean, in any other period in Welsh history, I would have the results of this qualifying campaign tattooed on my chest. It wasn't. You know.
How are France getting on? They all. It's all sad and angry. And
the fact that Deschamps has his contract has been extended until 2020 has baffled many, myself included. The fact that we couldn't wait until the World Cup and to see what was going to happen there, and that we've. Basically, we are with Deschamps, who is, I wouldn't say that it divides opinion in France, because I think opinion is strongly against him and has been now for a while. And people are wondering, how can it be that with a group of players that's immensely talented and the depth of the squad, that we are not better than we are at the moment? And that, in a way, the Euro was... flattered to deceive, because placing the final, yeah, but you look at how we got to the final. I mean, we played one great game just against Germany, but that's about it. But the group of players is quite magnificent. Interestingly, Steven Nzonzi is part of the squad. It's taken a while because he's never been called. He doesn't have a cap, but obviously...
That's why Big Sam tried to get him, didn't he?
Steven Nzonzi? Mm. Well, super player. I think everybody's agreed on that. Also,
him not being English was an issue.
Okay. Other new face, Benjamin Pavard, somebody who has had an interesting trajectory, because he actually went to the Bundesliga to get a job as a footballer, plays for Stuttgart, and now has been, I think, is one who is for me in contention for a place in the 23 to go to Russia, is one who is on the way up. And apart from that, you know, it's... Nothing as excited. We're not as excited as we should be with the prospect of a World Cup. When you see, I'm looking. You know, these are the guys that these are attacking players for these games against Wales and Germany. Griezmann, Giroud, Lacazette, Coman, Mbappe, Thauvin, Martial, and Nabil Fekir, who is back. Thank goodness. Who is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful player, as I've said many times on this pod, and who is now seriously back from his injury. And is basically running the show for Lyon.
Griezmann's fit for Friday night, isn't he?
I should think so.
I saw footage of his first touch on Twitter, and it was chilling. The other thing with Wales is that we're not a one-man team, absolutely not, but we are a three-man team. And Bale, Ramsey and Allen were only together for 270 minutes over the course of the qualifying campaign. So you can do it without one of them.
Yeah.
But especially, for instance, against Ireland, you can't do it without two of those three. And the other person I didn't mention in that USA 94 team was Dean Saunders. What a side on paper. Absolutely haunted by that, but never mind.
Thanks, Ellis.
Thank you for having
me. Thanks, Philippe.
Oh, yeah.
And I should just say, we have a live show on the 14th of December. Me, Baz, Barney, Jonathan Wilson, maybe Sid Lowe, to be confirmed. So it's at the Emanuel Centre in London. Please come. Production meetings have started, haven't they, Barry?
Yes. Yes,
they have. They've started. You know.
There's just some exciting ideas.
Oh, there's no such thing as a bad idea at this stage.
Yeah.
For them.
Well, no, a couple of yours were bad.
Are you not going to sing that song?
No.
Oh, go on.
I don't sing.
Oh, no, you just have to... I won't give it away. Okay, so yeah, come and watch what will be a work in progress for the live shows of 2018. And is there anything else you need to plug? Oh, yeah, we're nominated unbelievably for the best football podcast in the Football Supporters Federation awards. So please go on their website and vote for us. Thanks.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.